On this week's 51%, we bring you more of an interview with a woman who aims to balance the masculine-feminine scales, and meet a slam poet whose art form is mixing with more traditional poetry.
A lot of my poetry is very raw. A lot of it is based off of real life experience and like real pain or loss or love that I've had.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. We start by bringing you part two of an interview focused on tapping into the power of femininity in leadership. Social entrepreneur Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers in 1990 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has spent more than 20 years investigating the power of femininity to solve some of humanity's greatest challenges, both environmental and social, convening in an annual conference. In part one of the interview, Simons spoke with KALW's Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller about how leading from the feminine began. This second part of the interview delves into the conference itself and more. Schiller asked Simons what it will take for that shift to happen when we're no longer fighting the system, but creating a system where both the masculine and feminine are valued.
Well, I think we'll get there. I mean, I'm deeply optimistic by nature. And I think there's evidence of it in, you know, when I look at couples raising children in their 20s and 30s right now, there's an awful lot more sharing of housework and of parenting. And, you know, I look at my grandkids and I see how beautifully their parents just pass the ball. And there's no question about what's mom's role and what's dad's role. They're just co-parenting. So I think there's a lot of evidence of change. And I think in a way, it's a generational shift that we're experiencing. And this is related to how we heal from systems of privilege and bias. And I've been a student for the last 10 years or so about white privilege and racial bias. And what I've learned is that there are a lot of things that translate from gender justice to racial justice. So for instance, what I've learned from being a woman of privilege, from being a white woman in this country, is that privilege creates blinders and it normalizes its own experience. And so it took me a long time to understand that I had privilege and to not feel guilty or ashamed or weird about it, but to actually embrace it so that I could say, I'm going to use this privilege to help make it different. And I think the same is true for men. I think that, you know, women know when we talk in circles or conferences of women about the experience of being in an all-male boardroom and raising an idea and having it fall on deaf ears, and then the guy next to you says the same thing in a different language and everybody jumps on it. Every woman around is nodding her head because we all know that. We've all experienced it. Men, however, don't see that. They don't see it when it happens. And it's not anyone's fault as an individual. It's a challenge of the system, is how do we awaken to the blinders that privilege creates for us?
Tell me about some of the work that you've been doing with women's leadership training.
Well, for the last 12 years, we have been developing a program that we called Cultivating Women's Leadership. And it's a 6-day immersion experience that we invite women to apply for and then select each cohort of 20 women very carefully. And we've been selecting women for a number of criteria. One criteria, for example, was we really want to know how passionate they are about making change in the world, because those are the women we most want to work with. And another is there evidence of this woman being able to influence change in her community or constituency? And the third criteria, which is perhaps the most interesting, is that we select each cohort to optimize for diversity in every way. And what that means is that each cohort typically has women ranging in age from their 20s to their 70s or 80s, and across all kinds of ethnic diversity, and across sexual preference and discipline. And so you get this, you know, a group of women who in normal life in our country would never get to encounter each other in a deep way, and give them 6 days to do a lot of deep work, both on an individual level and with each other. And by the end of the 6 days, what's been remarkable is that very often those women have bonded really deeply with each other. And they've formed connections that are lasting years later, which is part of our intention. So that's been a journey. We always knew that it was important to us to have a lot of ethnic and racial diversity in the room. And it was hard to do, partly because at that time, I was doing most of the facilitating with the woman who I really co-founded the program with, who was another white woman. And I read a book by Linda Tarr Whalen called Women Lead the Way. And what I learned from that book was that there is social science that shows that for any minority to fully show up in a group, they need to be at least 30% of the room. And I thought, well, that's so interesting because, I mean, part of what they said was until they're at 30%, they just don't feel flanked enough to take the risks to really be outspoken and really be themselves. And then I reflected on that in relation to the percentage of women in our House and Senate, which is not even remotely close, right? And we made a decision as soon as I read that book. We said, okay, from this point forward, we are always going to have a minimum of 30% women of color in our groups. And we brought in facilitators who were women of color so that there was always a third facilitator. 33% of us was a woman of color. And as soon as we did that, we started getting 35 to 50% women of color in our trainings. And that's been an incredible teaching for me and really interesting in terms of all the things we're talking about, from the boardroom to classrooms to, in this case, learning environments and gathering groups together.
Well, I'd love to talk more about how you ultimately embraced your role as a leader. So, you know, the Etney Reader says, you know, amazing things about you, puts you on their cover. You say no. And then you go and you try and understand why you might have felt that way. And so how have you come to terms with yourself?
Well, I had this big turning point moment when I turned 40. So it was 20 years ago, and I made myself several promises at that point, and one of them was about understanding and unpacking this leadership conundrum that I'd gotten into, and another was that I decided that I needed to learn to live more from my feminine side. And all my friends said, are you kidding? You're so feminine. And I said, well, it may look that way to you, but on the inside, I can tell you the way I've navigated my adult life has been through what I experience as my more masculine qualities. You know, I've relied heavily on my intellect and my analysis and my capacity for strategic thinking and my strong body and ability to power through and be persevering at all costs. And what I knew was that there were a lot of parts of me that felt under-exercised, under-seen, under-acknowledged. And so I began exploring that. And what I found was that it was like every cell in my body said yes when I started doing that. There was something deep inside me that was affirmed and that said, oh yeah, your dreams. Oh, yeah, listening to your intuition. Oh, what about this sensual thing? Like, what about listening to your body's wisdom? And what I began to realize was that from my gender lens perspective, part of the inheritance of a biased culture has been that we value the intellect over all of our other ways of knowing. And so I really went through a conscious process of trying to turn up the volume on all of my other ways of knowing and practice valuing them. And I think part of how I did that really was through gathering and facilitating groups of women The first time I gathered women was actually in 2002, and I convened 35 very diverse women leaders for a gathering called Unreasonable Women for the Earth.
And I love the title.
It was inspired by an amazing activist named Diane Wilson, who had spoken at Bioneers. And at the end of her talk, she said, I'm going to adapt a George Bernard Shaw quote that says, you know, and he wrote it about men, but I'm going to say it about women. And she said, a reasonable woman accepts the world as it is, and an unreasonable woman works to change the world as he knows it needs to be. So, as she knows it needs to be. So, she said, looking out at the audience, I encourage you all to be unreasonable because the earth really needs us now. And that phrase just stuck in my head. So, I wound up convening 35 amazing women, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was making it all up as I went along. And we spent 4 or 5 days together. And in a very beautiful place. And what actually emerged from that gathering was Code Pink, Women for Peace.
How about that?
Which is kind of a good outgrowth of something called Unreasonable Women. I learned that it's very important what title you organize under.
Would you say leading from the feminine and leading from the heart are interchangeable expressions, or would you define them slightly differently?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I think we're in a time where language can be a trap. And so leading from the heart is much more accessible to most people. However, for me, it's not the same because leading from the feminine is bigger than leading from the heart. It actually includes leading from your connection to the divine or spirit, as well as intuition, as well as your body's awareness. I think they're all intelligences that have been chronically undervalued. So for me, leading from the feminine includes all those three realms, not just the heart.
It's so refreshing because I just feel like we're living in this world that is being led by fear.
Yeah.
And that all of the decisions that are being made, you know, at the government level and probably at the corporate level and maybe sometimes at the family level are based on fear.
Yes.
And yes. It's messing with us. Mm-hmm. And the way you're talking about it, it's, you know, it feels like it's completely the inverse.
Well, it's really interesting you say that. I agree. And I think that we are living through a time when pretty well anyone alive and paying attention is dealing with some post-traumatic stress. I mean, I think life is that stressful right now. And I think young people growing up with an awareness of climate change, it's a big stressor. And so part of what I'm interested in is really how do we develop the capacity for resilience in ourselves? And some of that means going against the tide, for sure, you know, because with things speeding up as much as they are and as much media and as much information coming at us and all that stuff, it's becoming increasingly important to slow down and to actually go inside. You know, there's a very interesting correlation to all this stuff about the feminine, too, which I love and I remind myself often, which is that Carl Jung suggested that the feminine is our interiority and the masculine is our exterior. And when you think about all that fear-based, panic-driven motion, it's very externally focused. And it's pursuing some imagined safety or security that probably isn't very real. And I feel like the only real security lies inwardly and in our relationships. I think it's really through, you know, a web of connection to the people we love and who love us, and also to the places we love and the creatures we love and the whatever it is we love, you know, that's, to me, that's security. Because we all know, you know, corporations are laying people off right and left. And this whole notion that you're going to just have a straight up career and then retire with a gold watch, it ain't happening anymore, you know? So I think we need to shift our understanding of what security really means. And also, You know, for me, what's exciting about the path that keeps revealing itself to me is inviting people into a life of meaning, because there's an awful lot of distraction out there. And what I found, you know, it's part of the work we do in these women's leadership retreats. We do something we call a purpose marathon, and it's a very long afternoon where that has a lot of repeated questioning in it. And it's sort of like peeling an onion skin, because you go deeper and deeper inside yourself to notice what you really love dearly and what all your life has been a really resonant thing and what breaks your heart open. You know, I know for me, when I read stories about whales dying of stomach cancer because of all the plastic inside them, it breaks my heart. You know, and when I learn about the rate of extinction and that we may not have large mammals in another 20, 30 years on this planet, it really hurts me. And I don't know why that is, and I don't really care why that is. I care that it motivates me and that it's a way into my deepest passion. And so for me, I feel like the work of this time is for each of us to find what we're most exactly called to do and then invest ourselves there. You know, I once had a guide suggest to me that I was very impatient about finding my path. And I thought, why don't I know what it is? And why isn't it clear? And how do I get there faster? And what she said was, she suggested that I invest in my longing. She said, your longing lives in a chamber behind your heart. And if you invest your attention there, it will attract to you what you most want to have happen. And, you know, I didn't know if I believed in it or not, but I tried it. And I actually think it works.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to slow down?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One piece of advice was also about identifying your purpose, but it's related to how to slow down and how to listen inwardly. And so I had a great teacher say to me, pay exquisite attention inwardly to what makes your flame grow brighter. And she said, you have to be very still and pay a lot of attention, because sometimes that flame just perks up just in an instant and it's like, poof. And if you're not paying attention, you'll miss it. So that was great guidance. And the other thing that actually is very alive in me these days, I'm teaching a workshop with a woman who is a wonderful mindfulness teacher. And she lived on a Zen monastery for 7 years. And in many ways, I think what she has done is to feminize meditation and Zen. And what she teaches is that meditation is the subtlest form of self-love. So, you know, so it's this quality, and I can't profess to say that I'm a great meditator, I'm not, but there's a quality of really deep listening inwardly to all the parts of yourself that feels to me like a great way to slow down. And the other way that I practice all the time is being in nature, is go to nature, you know, and I always find that when I'm depressed or stressed or freaked out or confused, being in nature is my solace.
That was Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers, speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. Hear Schiller's other conversations at inflectionpointradio.org and on her Inflection Point podcast. And you can hear the first part of the interview in 51% show number 1465. Slam poets and sonnet lovers usually don't hang out together, but in Winona, Minnesota, they do. KFAI's Sylvia Thomas reports on an unusual poetry pairing that's redefining local definitions of the art form.
3 years ago, Nicole Ramsey ducked out of her dorm room and crashed a local poetry reading. She was new to town, a college freshman at St. Mary's University in Winona. And she was a rookie poet. As she settled into her seat, Ramsey heard poems like this.
One wave follows another beneath the heel of the wind. The spray blows landward, but lacking salt or iodine, it smells oddly Protestant.
Then it was her turn.
I read a poem, and it was like a trashy poem about weird things that I did at a party and like peeing on a building. And afterwards, this one woman who must have been 70 at the youngest came up to me and was like, I loved that poem. It reminded me of when I was young. And that moment kept me coming back.
So in between classes and studying, Ramsey found time to attend readings sponsored by the Winona Poet Laureate Program, a local creative writing initiative.
You don't think of that when you see anyone who's, you know, 50, 60 years older than you. You don't think, oh, wow, they were once 21, too, peeing on school buildings.
Ramsey became a regular at the readings, soaking in the aroma of espresso at the Blue Heron Coffee House as she listened to other people's work. And she read her own poems, too.
The thing about Nicole is that she's not afraid.
This is Ken McCullough. He's a regular at the readings.
Whenever Nicole reads in an open mic situation, everybody who hears her, even, you know, the veteran poets, they say, wow, she is really good.
And I stopped shaving my legs when they weren't smooth like the other girls with porcelain bulimia and straight B report cards. And I would go to school and hear the whisperings of the off-white Dyke Oreo. And he once told me no one would ever love a girl like me.
Most of her poems have to do with social justice in one way or another. And I know that every time I hear her, I start thinking myself about what I could be doing that works in that same mode. I figure it's going to be distinctly different from what she does, but people are going to say, I've never heard him work in that style before.
Slam poetry, how I interpret it, is there's a heavy emphasis on the spoken element of it rather than like the written word. 300 girls disappeared and we forgot. Which leads to the question, when do Black Lives Matter? Where I say 300 girls disappeared and we forgot. That's a line that I was like, I have to stop in this one and think of it. Because a lot of people don't even like remember or realize that Boko Haram is still alive and well and terrorizing humans.
That and other troubling themes are at the heart of Ramsey's work.
A lot of my poetry is very raw. A lot of it is based off of real life experience and like real pain or loss or love that I've had.
So after 3 years of sharing her work at local readings, Ramsey, even though she's barely old enough to drink, recently applied to be the city's poet laureate.
Basically, even though they made the requirements so much less than what it has been in years past, I still didn't meet them. I definitely applied for a job I wasn't qualified for.
The judges saw it that way too. They chose someone else, Ken McCullough, the guy you heard earlier in this story, for the position. But they liked Ramsey's work so much, they offered her a gig as associate poet laureate. And since she'd taken a break from school to catch up on bills, she was making lattes when she heard the news.
I was actually at work and one of the women on the Fine Arts Commission came in and she like pulled me aside and I'm in my apron and everything and she's like, just to let you know, it's going to be official. It's not official yet. Like, don't tell anyone, but it's going to happen. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, I'm going to tell everyone.
In Winona, poet laureates read and write poetry for citywide occasions like bridge christenings, historic meetings and such. On the surface, McCullough and Ramsey appear to be an unusual pair. He's a gray-bearded 73-year-old. She's a sassy 21. But the poets say that they look forward to working together as poet laureate and associate poet laureate. For KFAI, I'm Sylvia Thomas.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1466.